You know, one of my absolute favorite things about traveling is not so much seeing all the typical tourist attractions, but going out and watching the behavior and culture of dogs in different countries. We can learn so much by observing how dogs navigate their worlds in other places on our planet. And I've been wanting to chat with Sindhor Pangal for a long time because she is one of the world's foremost experts on street dogs, or streeties, as she refers to them in the most endearing way. We chat about the challenges dogs face living in India, as well as the many benefits of not actually being confined in a home environment. I think you're really going to enjoy hearing Sindhor share her unique insights in this episode. If you are enjoying The Bitey End of the Dog, you can support the podcast by going to aggressivedog.com, where there are a variety of educational opportunities to learn more about helping dogs with aggression issues, including the upcoming Aggression in Dogs Conference happening from September 30th through October 2nd, 2022 in Providence, Rhode Island, with both in-person and online options. You can also learn more about the Aggression in Dogs Master Course, which is the most comprehensive course available anywhere in the world for learning how to work with and help dogs with aggression issues. Hey everyone, I'm back with a very special guest this week. I have been wanting to record this episode for years, even though the podcast hasn't been around for years. This is a topic that I'm deeply interested in learning more about. This week, I've got Sindhor Pangal from India, she's a canine behavior consultant, a canine myotherapist, and an engineer by qualification. She is a TEDx speaker, the author of the book Dog Knows, and an independent ethology researcher studying the free-ranging dogs in India. Her studies have been published by IAABC and PPG Blog in the US, was presented at the PDTE Summit in the UK, and was mentioned in the book Canine Confidential by Dr. Mark Beckoff and a National Geographic bookazine called The Genius of Dogs. She's currently pursuing her master's in anthrozoology from Exeter University and is the principal and director of Barks. Barks offers a one-of-a-kind UK-accredited Level 4 Diploma on Canine Behavior and Ethology and boasts of students from all parts of India and across the globe. Sindhor is also the country representative for Pet Dog Trainers of Europe, PDTE. Welcome, Sindhor. I'm really excited for this episode.
I'm very excited too. Thank you for having me. I can't wait for this.
Yeah, so we're going to jump right into the topic of street dogs. But before we do that, I want to actually make sure we're defining these terms correctly, because before the show started recording, you were educating me on some of the different terminology for it. And then when we kind of think about that term street dogs, it can encompass a lot of different dogs in our minds, right? Especially here in the US. So tell me more, educate me more about the different terms or what you would describe as dogs.
Right. This one is an important one to talk about, and not everybody understands why it's important until you really start unwrapping it. I have heard a lot of different terms being used for these dogs, and quite honestly, though I stick to street dog now, I'm not entirely convinced that's the right term either. I think the technical term is really free living dogs, but I think we use the word street dog, and that's okay. And in India, we fondly call them streeties, and that's what I'd like to do, because we always used to like to use terms that sort of express how fond we are of them, right? So I like the term streetie. But, and this is the reason why I want to talk about it, I have heard people use the term stray dog, feral dog, wild dog to describe these dogs. And there are a few things to note here. First up, they're not stray dogs. Stray dogs are ex-pet dogs or ex-companion dogs that have strayed. They have strayed from where they're supposed to be, right? It's kind of this matter out of place kind of a thing. They've strayed somewhere. But these are not dogs that have strayed anywhere. They are inhabitants of this space. They've lived there. They were born on the streets, brought up by other dogs for generations. They've been free living animals, free range animals. They're not a product of abandonment. And one thing that I frequently bring up is, you know, when you talk about the history of the natural history of dogs, we talk about how dogs co-evolved around human beings. And I don't know which school you come from. You could say 10,000 years ago, 40,000 years ago, you know, you put your number on it and you picture those very, very early years of, you know, free living dogs around human beings. And what's really fascinating is we still get to see and experience that in India. And that really is fascinating. So they are not stray dogs. That's not really what they're seeing. They're not feral dogs either, because, again, the definition of feral is an animal that was, and when I say an animal, I'm using that term to specifically talk about non-human animals here. So a feral animal is one that was domesticated or in a domestic setting and now has kind of, in quotes, gone wild, right? Neither of these are applicable to our streeties. They never were pet dogs or companion dogs or, you know, in a captive setting. They were always free and they're not wild. People picture them to be very aggressive with a lot of conflict. And today we will probably discuss a lot of it. It's not really true. I've not seen friendlier dogs or friendlier animals. It's just fascinating. And I definitely want to talk a lot more about it. And then the last term that gets used a lot is wild dogs. Now, we must realize that there are wild dogs in India. There are, but those are not Canis familiaris. They're Q1 Alpino, Dhol, the wild dogs that live in the jungles of India. They're not dogs, not the ones that we know, at least. They're entirely different species. And so I think this terminology really becomes important because one is studies done on stray dogs are not necessarily relevant to street dogs or streeties. Studies done on feral dogs are not necessarily representative of free-ranging dogs. They're very different. And feral dogs in particular, stray dogs are harder to see in India because they don't make it. Indian streets are hard to make it. So if you've not grown up on the streets, you're not going to make it. But with feral dogs, they live a different life. They have a different ontology. They have a different environment. So they have different behaviors, including different social structures and their interaction with conspecifics and others. And so that differentiation is important, particularly if you're going to say, hey, we're going to be getting technical about it. We're going to be getting accurate about it. We're now down to the details, right? And then this becomes important. So I think it's really important. And I would love for people to, if they're listening in, to really carry that in your mind and be critical about literature that you see on these dogs and understand that there's a difference. And the other reason I want to emphasize the difference, and I'm going to insist on calling them streeties, is the optics of it, because these terms like wild dogs and feral dogs are so overloaded that there's a mental picture painted that's just not real. It's not fair. So to me, they are streeties. That's the ones that I see. They're the ones that I see. They're the ones I love and interact with. And so let's call them streeties for this talk.
Yes. And I'm so glad you're clarifying all these terms, because I love actually the term free living dogs, because it doesn't imply anything bad, right? When we hear those terms, you know, wild or feral, we're kind of automatically puts our mind into a negative space when we hear those words. So words do matter. So free living dogs is really a great term in the way you put it. Do you differentiate between dogs that are somewhat owned by somebody? So you might have, you know, when I was in Mexico, you have some street vendors. So the dogs come, in air quotes, home to that particular person's location. And then the next morning they're off and they're off doing whatever they are. And then just in the evening, they just happen to come to that same spot. And maybe that person feeds the dog, or maybe even lets them into their stoop area or somewhere. And so they technically just keep going back to that same location. So we could argue that they have like a home there. Do you differentiate that between dogs that don't have a human sort of companion of their own that they go back to?
Right. You're going to see every variation of this in a country like India. And so, yes, we do see them. And it's not as simple a distinction either, because there are so many shades of that there as well. But I think it's important to note when we talk about Indian streeties or Indian free living dogs is that what's unique about them is that they enjoy a constitutional protection, in that it is illegal in the country to either kill them or even relocate them. So you can't actually move them out of where they are at, because, and this is interesting, the spirit of the law when it was written recognized that when you move a dog from one territory to another, it can cause so much conflict that it can kill them. And so it impacts their welfare. So relocating them is not an option. They may lose their ability to survive. And in a place like my city in Bangalore, that law is sort of, the government is held responsible, held accountable to actually make that happen. So you really do see quite a bit of friendly attitude towards these dogs. And that means then there are people opening their doors to these dogs. They're willing to let them come in and go out. And at the same time, the country, sort of the philosophy in many people in the country is that their right to freedom is something that it's a fundamental right that they should have or they already have. It's a sentimental aspect of this. So you're going to have people who are going to enable the life of a free living dog to live a free life. And how do they enable it? By saying, I don't mind throwing a few scraps out every evening. I will come out and give you food at the same place at the same time, or rather most evenings. I'll let you come into sort of the perimeter, you know, of my property. Maybe, and these dogs are not exactly homing. And that's interesting because so I heard some of my friends call it inside-outside dogs because we couldn't come up with a better term. And one of my students described it really nicely. She said, this dog uses my house as an Airbnb. She comes in when she wants to, and she just doesn't pay for it. But typically the times that they tend to come in is to, it is weather-related, right? When it's raining, the monsoons are around the corner. So when it's raining, torrential rains, or when it's really hot. And of course, if you give them access to your sofa, then they're there napping for a long time. But what's really interesting about them is if you try to convert them into pet dogs, they will fight you. They will try to run away. They're master escape artists. And so that's interesting. And it does impact them in terms of behavior. And so for me, that's interesting. But I don't think the government per se looks at them differently. And so that's an interesting problem for the Indian government, which is trying to kind of roll out, the best way to say this is kind of these colonial practices that don't necessarily fit in other parts of the world, like dog licensing, the idea of sort of getting everybody accountable. And the reason I'm talking about this is I just finished a paper on it, exploring sort of decolonized approaches to dealing with dogs in India. And so when the government comes in and tries to classify them as owned dogs, where you need a license, and unowned dogs, where you know, they don't need a license and there isn't one person accountable, then what happens to all these dogs in between? The ones who come home, like you mentioned, we definitely have a lot of those, particularly in villages, or like our Airbnb guests. Where do they fit in? Are they owned? Are they unowned? Who is responsible for them? And who provides care for them? These are interesting questions that India still is in the process of figuring out. So, but they're interesting conversations to have.
So I want to dive deeper into that aspect of things. You mentioned earlier that, you know, streeties do have a tough life, but at the same time, the government is doing, has some laws in place to protect them in certain aspects. So can you dive into that further, sort of that dichotomy of having these protections, but also having this, you know, a difficult life there, and some of the aspects of what a difficult life they are experiencing?
Right. I think the best way to understand it is to probably understand free living life the way human beings have it. The truth is that not all of us have the best possible lives. And so there are going to be many different kinds of challenges, from social challenges, shortage of resources, to conflict. But at the same time, there's also this inherent thing in pretty much, I suppose, all living beings that can move is to value freedom quite highly. So perhaps that's probably why streeties continue to kind of go back to that life. Again, not all of them. So you will see every variation. There are dogs that get themselves adopted. So that's an interesting thing to talk about. But the kind of conflict that these dogs see has to do with food. What if they don't find resources? Many of them will find what I would probably call patron homes or guardians, homes outside which they hang out, or restaurants, butchers, and they even know closing hours with these guys. So if they have, if they, their haunt, let's call it their haunt. See, you know, they're so poorly studied that we don't have words for a lot of these things. But if they have decided that a particular restaurant or a particular butcher's is their home or their haunt or their feeding place, they know closing hours, they will turn up there and seek food. But there is the risk that there could be other dogs, there could be fight over it. Doesn't always happen. I think the bigger issues have to do with disease. And that's something that is being addressed by sort of mass vaccination programs. Conflict with humans who abuse them willfully. That's not too many in the large scheme of things. I suppose all parts of the world have their share of people who do terrible things to animals. Mm-hmm. And in a country of a billion, that kind of becomes a very large number, right? When you, and then to deal with traffic, oh my goodness, if you've seen videos of traffic in India, mm-hmm. most humans from outside India can't cross the streets in India. But these dogs do it and they survive. And I find it fascinating. And that's another thing that I have footage, videos of dogs doing it. And it's just incredible. I'd say those are the kind of the big conflict areas. But in a city like Bangalore, there are not only people who will kind of open up their homes to them. There are also people who call themselves feeders. And they go out and can feed anywhere between 5 to 10 dogs to even 100, 200 or 1,000, 2,000 dogs per day with fresh cooked food made at their cost. And they take it out and they feed. And it's not 100 dogs that they don't know. It's not the first 100 dogs they meet. They know every one of these 100 dogs. In fact, one feeder said to me, he said, if there's a scratch on one of the dogs, I will recognize it. I will know he's in pain. I know something is off that day. So they know them. They love them. They know them. They know them by name. They recognize each other. And so there's a huge network of that, which is kind of burgeoning. And, you know, there are a lot more people in particularly in Bangalore city and some cities across India who are doing more and more of this. So there is that kind of a care. And then the government does a little bit of care as well in terms of which is required to do and sometimes delivers on it is free of cost vaccinations and free of cost animal birth control procedures. Of course, there are shelters that are focused on providing care for injured animals and kind of trying to get them a home or provide them a place to convalesce. So that's kind of the support structure that's there. And it's really, and I think of, I should definitely mention this as the top of the list of things that really help these dogs is there are an incredible number of people in India who will fight for them legally to ensure that they retain their life, their right to freedom. And I think that is really a game changer.
That is, yeah, absolutely. A big part of the conversation I want to have is just how much that impact of freedom has on their behavior, both positive ways and negative ways. But yeah, there's so many things I want to unpack in what you were just talking about. And one of the aspects you mentioned when we're talking about dogs around the world that have access to traffic in the streets and being injured or disease, you know, there's lots of considerations there. Often the argument is, okay, yes, they can have a very robust, enriched social life, but there's a cost to that in the risk of, you know, traffic, getting hit by cars, getting injured, having run-ins with other animals or dogs that are a dog that's contained, for instance, all day in a home is not going to experience. So what are the diseases I know that rabies may be one consideration, and what are the diseases that are most impactful for the dogs there, and how is that being dealt with that you're seeing?
Well, the usual suspects, you have your rabies, CD, distemper, leptospirosis, to some extent, I guess, tick fever too, but that's something that doesn't surface easily. And then they're definitely going to be pretty much everything that most people see, but, you know, it's hard to kind of notice it in street dogs because you really need very, very close observation to know that they're suffering from other ailments. And of course, injury, right? Sort of sustaining physical injury, either through fights with other dogs or human artifacts or humans themselves. And I think in terms of rabies, there is the government is trying, I would definitely say there needs to be more will. There is a pretty good research in terms of not just how to capture and vaccinate these dogs and the efficacy of programs of that kind to create a rabies-free environment. And there are some wonderful success stories in India, but really we need more political will to kind of roll it out. And then other things like rabies vaccines that can be orally consumed, so it can sort of be put in eggs and tossed out to these dogs. So that kind of an effort. And when the dogs are caught for neutering, they're usually vaccinated for other diseases. So that provides some layer of protection as well. But yes, a free life is a life that is wrought with the challenges of a free life, be it a wild animal, be it an urban animal, be it the pigeons in the sky in the city, or be it human beings. I mean, it's true of all of us.
So Are there laws in place? You mentioned, you know, some of the abuse that can happen. Are there laws in place against that particular aspect? You mentioned there's, it's obviously illegal to kill the dogs but, or relocate them, but do you see much prosecution for abuse or is people out in the streets maybe doing, witnessing that happening and anybody doing anything about it?
Yes and no. Yes to the first question and no to the second, which is yes, there are laws, but we don't see it being implemented as much. Mm-hmm. And the laws, while the laws are not too bad, actually, the fines that come with it, the punishment for it is, it's ridiculous. It's like a 5 cent fine, if I'm somewhere in that range. Like mm-hmm. it's outdated. It's from the, you know, post-independence, 1947 kind of a thing. It's just ridiculous numbers. It may have been updated after that, but still, it's just ridiculous. And because of that, though there are a lot of people who try really hard to kind of hold the government accountable to say, okay, you need to hold this abuser accountable, what does that accountability mean? It really doesn't go that far. So I think that's a very painful thing for many people who fight for the welfare of free dogs in India, which is to push the government to say we need something more sensible. The sentiment is there, but it's just not caught up with the times. That's a conversation that needs to be had.
And so in that regard, the general culture of, you know, when the public is walking by dogs on the street there, so you see Streety and people are walking by, what are the general interactions like? Because I know if somebody saw a dog out on the streets here where I live, they would call out the National Guard and everybody would be chasing the dog to try to capture it, to figure out where it belongs or where it lives. And if you go to other countries, there everybody's just walking by a dog that may be sleeping in the sidewalk and just nobody's touching the dog or having that inherent need to stick their hand in the dog's face. And so what is the culture like there? Is it... And how much does the disease also impact that? Are there some, because of the potential risk for rabies or things like that, do you see that impacting things greatly? Or where people are like, oh, stay away from the dogs, yeah. or they just kind of ignore the dogs, or are they actively trying to engage with the dogs?
So like in any part of the world, I think people in India will fall into three buckets. People who like dogs or love dogs, people who are kind of indifferent to them, and people who are afraid or hate them, right? So you obviously are going to see all three. But dogs are such a big part of reality that it's something that you just need to learn to walk by no matter where you fall in this. You need to learn to walk past them. Otherwise, you're just not going to get past, you know, the first few steps you get out there. Disease is not something, so it's really interesting that you asked that because I was actually reading up on the attitudes of people in India towards rabies and things like that. And it's sometimes it's frustrating for people that disease doesn't seem to be on top of people's minds. And I think that frustration is probably unwarranted because there's a reason why it's not on top of their mind, because street dogs, when they get unwell, are very unlikely to be around people. They tend to actually go and hide. And in fact, many people who care for streeties, if they don't find their familiar dogs, the first thing that they're going to suspect is that the dog is unwell. Why hasn't he turned up? He's hidden somewhere and he's unwell. And sure enough, that's something that we do see a lot of. Of course, the late part of rabies is significantly different, right? The last part of rabies is when they're actually out there and it's a very, very sad situation and difficult one too. So I don't think that's a deterrent for people. I think a lot of people learn to walk past them. People who are afraid of them learn simple things. Like you see a dog on the right side of the street, cross over and walk on the left side of the street. So things like that, I think is already, you just got to do that. What option do you have? There's nobody to call. There isn't a National Guard to call. There isn't anybody to call. And I must point out at this point that one of the last studies that we were doing with streeties, we were trying to kind of see how they respond to human beings and just our gestures and attitudes. And what I found really interesting is that street dogs are very good at figuring out where in this bucket you are. And that, I think, is interesting. It's very key to survival. And they will kind of cooperate with your intent there. So if your intent is to kind of walk past the dog, you will see that the dog will choose not to engage with you either. They don't make themselves conspicuous. So it's almost like people are blind to the dog, that there is a dog. There is something. And dogs make themselves quite comfortably blind. I mean, invisible. They can do that. Whereas if you are somebody who likes a dog, and we can talk about this in a bit, but they will pick you out in a crowd. They will pick you out in a crowd and actually come and approach you. And if you're somebody who has malicious intent toward the dog, many of them do a pretty good job at figuring that out too.
You see, this is why I want to come there. Forget Disney World, forget Las Vegas. Yeah. I am coming to see you just to experience that, because that is what excites me, is that just the behavior of dogs. So let's jump into that, since this is a behavior podcast. Yeah. You know, kind of talk about a little bit more about that behavior and what you're seeing and how intelligent the dogs are, you know, and we often, as you were mentioning, we were talking about this before. It's that there's like this myth about, you know, streeties or street dogs may not be, you know, they don't have the same training or the same, you know, all the things we do to interact or to, you know, show off in our dogs here with our own dogs, but streeties are very intelligent. So talk more about that and what you're seeing.
I think I probably want to start this off by giving you a little anecdote straight out of my book, where I kind of explore the cognitive and social abilities of street dogs. And I kind of end that section by saying, particularly in reference to training and the kind of trained behaviors, right? Here is a dog that's capable of doing all of this. Here's an animal that's capable of telling a good, you know, a friendly, kind human versus somebody with malicious intent, knows how to cross the streets, knows how to problem solve, knows how to negotiate social structures with multiple dogs, friends and foes, and negotiate the politics of their world, which is another very interesting thing. Here's a dog that's able to do so much, figure out what's toxic food, what's not, what do you eat, what not, who do you beg from, how do you get yourself adopted if you want to, which human being is likely to adopt you, and how do you get yourself adopted? How do you beg? How do you procure food from people? I have even seen dogs being able to sort of go to their caretakers and seek medical help for themselves, for their friends. How are they communicating all of this? How are they reading us so well? How are they sizing us up so well? This is enormous amount of stuff that they're able to do. And here we are training them to do repetitive exercises like sit down, you know, give me a paw. It's just, and so, you know, this quote from, I don't know how many people are fans of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, but there's this robot in it, Marvin the Paranoid Android, and he keeps complaining, saying, I have the brain the size of a planet, and here you are asking me to open doors. Talk about job satisfaction, right? It's such an underutilized thing. You're getting so excited that you got your dog to learn 5 commands. And what I am seeing is a dog that doesn't need you to open your mouth and can look into your soul and figure out how to work with you and how to make you do things that is necessary for their survival. Are you kidding me? I mean, come on. That's really the depth of what we should be getting at. And I think that kind of starts shining a light on what these animals that we recognize as a dog, and we've brought them into our homes and we've kept them here. What are they capable of? How much do their minds work? And how? What are the complex things that they're able to actually figure out? I would love to see more curiosity around this. Which part of this would you like to know more about? Where shall we start?
I couldn't agree more with everything you're saying right now, because when you look, if you take a step back and just look at all the dogs around the world and the cultures of dogs and just how skewed, it's like shifted in such odd ways in what we're teaching dogs or how we're interacting with dogs in some environments and cultures, and how much things really don't make sense when you think about, you know, what's the point of teaching a dog how to sit, for instance, in a particular situation? Is it really that important? Is it really the things that dogs need to learn in a class? And when you look back and you look at the life of a streetie, it all starts to really come like full circle. Like, what are we doing here? How are we interacting with the dogs? What are our conversations like? What's the lifestyle we're bringing them into? So we're going to jump more back into that topic. We're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsor, and we'll be right back here with Centaur. Hey friends, it's me again, and I hope you are enjoying this episode. You may have figured out that something I deeply care about is helping dogs with aggression issues live less stressful, less confined, more enriched, and overall happy lives with their guardians. Aggression is so often misunderstood, and we can change that through continued education, like we receive from so many of the wonderful guests on this podcast. In addition to the podcast, I have two other opportunities for anyone looking to learn more about helping dogs with aggression issues, which include the Aggression in Dogs Master Course and the Aggression in Dogs Conference. If you want to learn more about the most comprehensive course on aggression taught anywhere in the world, head on over to aggressivedog.com and click on the Dog Pros tab and then the Master Course. The course gives you access to 23 modules on everything from assessment to safety to medical issues to the behavior change plans we often use in a number of different cases, including lessons taught by Dr. Chris Pockle, Kim Brophy, and Jessica Dolce. You'll also receive access to a private Facebook group with over 1,000 of your fellow colleagues and dog pros all working with aggression cases. After you finish the course, you also gain access to private live group mentor sessions with me, where we work through practicing many different cases together. And if you need CEUs, we've got you covered. We're approved for just about every major training and behavior credential out there. This is truly the flagship course offered on aggression in dogs, and is perfect for pet pros that want to set themselves apart and take their knowledge and expertise to the next level, or even for pet owners who are seeking information to help their own dog. And don't forget to join me for the third annual Aggression in Dogs Conference, either in person or online, from Providence, Rhode Island on September 30th through October 2nd, 2022. This year's lineup includes many of the amazing guests you might have heard on the podcast, including Suzanne Clothier, Jen Shryock, Simone Mueller, Dr. Amber Batson, Kim Brophy, Karishma War, Laura Monaco Torelli, Dr. Simone Gadbois, and many more. Head on over to aggressivedog.com and click on the conference tab to learn more about the exciting agenda on everything from advanced concepts and leash reactivity to using positive reinforcement to work with predatory behavior. And if you'd like to show off your support for the podcast, this year we teamed up again with the folks over at Wolf Culture for some catchy limited run conference merchandise. Wolf Culture is known for their witty, nerdy, and no-nonsense apparel that was created in 2019 to spread more awareness towards the use of humane training methods. Their apparel is here to help you start conversations, advocate for your animals, and rep force-free training in a different way. Don't forget to get your conference gear. It leaves the site after 12/31/2022. If you want 10% off your order, use the code BITEY10, BITEY10, at checkout. All right, welcome back. We're talking with Sinhor Pangal about street dogs, streeties, and all of the behavior aspects. And so let's continue on that conversation because it's fascinating for me. And you even see differences depending on what part of the world you are with the streeties and how they're interacting with people, and also dependent on the resources as well. So maybe we talk about that. We had talked about the feeders in India and the scarcity of food in some aspects. Whereas if you go to some other countries, you might see dogs in a very touristy area where they're going to be very picky about the food. You know, I know if I hand my dog a scrap of bread or something, she's going to suck that down like a vacuum, versus you go to try to give a piece of bread to a dog in a touristy area, they're like, I don't think so. And they're very well fed. They're definitely not having a hard time finding food. They're getting the best of the best from the tourists and from the vendors there. So let's talk about that, the scarcity of resources and how much it can impact the behavior and what you see there.
Right. I mean, such a wonderful topic and so much to talk about, like every aspect of this. But I must mention, so I have a story much like what you just mentioned. So we had a visitor coming down from Belgium, and she was doing a workshop on sensory integration for dogs. And we decided to do one of the workshops at a shelter. And what was interesting is there were two dogs there that had been brought in from the street because one of them was injured and so needed to recuperate, you know, got medical intervention and needed to recuperate. And the second one apparently just couldn't live without his friend. So he had been brought into the shelter just to hang out there. And shelters in India are a little bit different in that it's not all kenneled dogs. So many dogs just, they have free area that they run around in. They're not isolated. So this guy was just walking around the shelter, you know, like a tour guide around the shelter kind of a chap. And so he was brought in for the demo. So somebody said, hey, you know, we need a dog. And he was just hanging out with us. And we were like, yeah, let's do it. And so somebody decided to pull out my friend from Belgium decided to pull out some cheese to see if she could get him to get interested in what we were doing. And she had two types of cheese. And he was very, very clear. One type of cheese was a no, and the other was a yes. And guess what? He said no to the processed cheese and said yes to the fresh cheese. So, yeah, they got taste, huh? Don't you underestimate our streeties. They got taste and they know good cheese from bad cheese, okay? Absolutely, resources do impact behavior. And I think of all things, resources perhaps impact behavior in a very loud and significant way. So if you're putting them in a place where there is very limited resources, there is a fight for survival, and they need to instinctively know that there is going to be a fight for survival, which means they're already very agitated. They're in an agitated state of mind, and so there's going to be more conflict. When you're already agitated, you really don't have to look into, what triggered the conflict. It takes so little to trigger conflict if you are sort of in a very, wound up all the time about something or very stressed. I don't want to use the word stress because I think that word has just been used in so many contexts, incorrect contexts, but you get the point. It's a dog that is kind of on edge. And even in India, despite the constitutional protection, we have different states that do different things. So parts of the country where they are not supported with feeders, they're not supported through the state governments, actually go against the constitution and do illegal killing and things like that. We not only see dogs have higher degree of conflict among themselves, but also with human beings. Human dog conflict or human animal conflict is very high in these areas. They're extremely wary of human beings, very low amount of trust, and that's like fuel on wood, right? It's, you know, that's just waiting to snap that quickly. Definitely, you see dogs in Bangalore, on the other hand, particularly when it's almost quite easy to spot dogs that have feeders because they tend to be extremely friendly, almost to the point where I sometimes worry that they're not cautious enough. I wish they were a bit more cautious, but they do drop their guard and they're extremely friendly. There's a reason they do need to do that. They do need to swing in the opposite direction. And I keep reminding people this. Do not forget that a dog evolved in an ecological niche that included human beings, which means that we are a big part of their resources. We determine their survival. They have come to learn how to use us as a resource, not only asking for food. And that's another thing. A lot of people think that dogs are primarily predators. That's not what we see with free living dogs. They are primarily beggars. And the next form of food is scavenging. So the first form of food is convincing you to give them the fabulous cheese, right? So communicating with us, getting resources from us or medical intervention from us, resolving conflict. I've had dogs that use me when they realize that I'm a friendly person to use me to help resolve conflict with other dogs. That's just fascinating. So when we talk about resources, I think we have to factor in the human resource as well and see that it does play a huge impact on how they behave towards conspecifics and us.
Yeah. And what you're really kind of talking about is sort of the next chapter in the story of domestication, right? It's just, we're continuing in that aspect. We're just seeing it in a much grander scale and a more busy environment now, much more populated environments, and the long story of just acquiring resources for survival. So along those lines, I would love to hear you talk more about the aggression that you see in the dogs competing for these resources. Do you see very overt conflicts between the dogs where there's serious injuries, or is it much more conversational where you might see some teeth flashing but no injuries because of the risk or the expense of aggression in those contexts?
Yeah. You know, we owe a lot to Darwin, but I think one of the things that we probably have been suffering from is the idea of survival of the fittest. The notion of the way we've pictured it with this idea of fight to the top, fight for survival. But that life does not work like that. It just, especially if you look at a street dog, you realize that when there is conflict over resource, fighting for it regardless of whether you win the fight or lose the fight, you are worse off for it because you're likely to have sustained an injury. And if a street dog sustains an injury, it can get infested, maggots, and the dog can die. And so even if you don't get the food, often the more sensible thing to do, the survival of the fittest is the one that not fights the most ferociously. The fittest is the one that knows when to walk away and pick another day and knows when posturing will work. And when a big part of posturing, what you said, conversational, right? A big part of posturing is knowing who that posturing works with. You roll up your sleeves and you say, I'm ready for a fight. And you see the other person stand up and is bigger than you. And you say, all right, maybe not. And you definitely see that in street dogs. You definitely see it in all social beings. That's just the more sensible thing to do. It's just more adaptive to do it that way. When the lockdown happened, that was an interesting one. So when you have human beings, I mean, animals that have evolved in a ecological niche with human beings, something like a countrywide lockdown where all the human beings disappear, all the establishments close, all the butchers and the restaurants close. Now you have significantly changed the environment and you have dropped the resources significantly. So we did actually see a sudden spike in dogs moving all over the place, leaving their territories, getting into new territories. So there were fights based on that. And they had to kind of look for new sources. There was a lot of stress and tension. So we did see that. And I was talking to some of the feeders who, on a side note, another interesting thing the government did during the lockdown is gave permission to feeders. So they were one of the few people who were considered essential service. They could actually step out and feed the dogs. So many of them who started stepping out and feeding the dogs, I was kind of following up with them. I was just doing a very small bit right outside my house, but I wanted to talk to people who are feeding, you know, in large numbers because their dogs had now kind of scattered. And they said that after the first week or so, they quickly learned about their new reality. They learned about their new neighbors. They learned that there was no need to fight. They learned to share limited resources that had dropped in quality and quantity. Because the first few weeks of the or the months of the lockdown, we ourselves were struggling for provisions and food. So people really didn't have much to feed. There was no meat at the butchers. And so there was just, we were trying to make do with eggs and bread and whatever we could. And things that, like you said, things that streeties don't particularly want to eat. But they said, okay, they started eating it. There was lesser food that they learned to share and a new, and this is an interesting one, new social dynamics that they had to negotiate to say, right, so we got to figure this out. We got to learn to share. What makes them do that? What makes them go from fighting, you know, the first week and then the second week realizing, right, so this is not making sense. Let's try to talk this out. Don't you sometimes wish we do that a little bit more, human beings?
I was just going to say that. And how many lessons we can take just from that, you know, story you're telling and, you know, how to walk away from a Facebook post once in a while.
Yes.
You might not agree with, right? Because it's expensive behavior, right?
Yes.
We get ourselves into conflicts we don't want to or necessarily need to, you know?
Yeah.
So a little bit, we talked a little bit about the dog-dog aggression. What about dog-to-human aggression? You know, in some countries, it is not tolerated at all. There, any biting or even signs of aggression and that dog is, you know, kind of dealt with in that cultural way for that particular area. What about India? Do you see that it's tolerated or there's some tolerance for it or are dog bites completely out of the realm of acceptable?
Yeah. It's funny because if you had asked me this question about a month ago, my answer would have been different. I would have said that, yes, the people who do get bitten, and this is still a valid part of the answer, people who do get bitten, there is a good number of them, there are a good number of them, who can get significantly agitated by it and kind of, you know, ask for their pound of flesh kind of a thing, right? It's like really get very, very agitated about the whole thing. And it does lead to very, very dire consequences for the dog. And I sort of don't want to get into what can happen there. But yes, there is that anger. But what surprised me is that I recently was, for one of the papers that I was writing, I was going through a whole bunch of literature that I didn't know existed. And I just uncovered it recently, talking about attitudes of people towards dogs. And it was surprising to find that many of the people who get bitten don't blame the dog. don't blame the dog at all. And that was interesting. I think that might actually be a cultural thing. And the reason I didn't know about this a month ago is because you don't get to see that. When somebody doesn't blame the dog, they're not going to make a big deal of it. So you never hear about it. You know, the only times it gets surfaced to particularly people like me, you know, who work, who feel strongly about the welfare of these dogs, the only time it gets surfaced to us is when it's newsworthy, right? When it's clickbaity, when it's big, when it's angry. So I think our views probably are biased by it. So I would have probably said, yes, a lot of people do get very angry. But now, I don't know. Maybe I need to ask more about this and maybe I'll have a better answer for you the next time.
I will definitely be asking that question because the thought that comes to mind is the statistics on dog bites. And if we were to compare, for instance, the US versus India. Now, obviously, there's lots of different data points or ways of collecting data that would skew those. But if we were to take the same survey or the same data from both countries and to compare the number of dog bites per capita, how it would compare, and as also the serious dog bites or maybe even the fatalities, I would be curious to see the difference, because in a country of a billion versus, you know, 300 something million here in the US, what are the differences? Do you have a lot of dog bite fatalities that are not disease or vector related, so actual killings from dogs?
You know, that's a hard one to answer because a lot is, what is a lot, right? If even if one person or one dog dies, that's a lot. It's not, death is, any amount, it is a lot. I guess the point I'm making is, yes, it's going to be there. I can't put a number to it. I wouldn't dare to put a number to it because of the complexity of what we see, because it's not... So what kind of dog did this? Was it a pet dog? Was it a street dog? Was it a half... inside-outside dog that we spoke about, and that is political. And so you're not going to get numbers. People are not going to be willing to give those numbers out very easily. No. So that was another interesting thing that did come out in the study, is a lot of people underreport bites in India because they're worried that the dog is going to get persecuted for it. Of course, fatalities will get reported, but still underreported, like everything in India. All tragedies from India are underreported. And that's our biggest tragedy of it all. So yes, we do see it. But it's not a conversation that, to me, occupies a big part of my mind, because I think that's a sign of a system gone wrong, right? We should be looking at what comes before, what leads to it. We should be looking at more thorough vaccinations, more thorough, better care for these dogs, more integration between communities. It has been done repeatedly. So we have to follow those case studies to get into a situation where this doesn't happen. It is a very, very small number at the end of the day. And we do need to bring in ethologists to ask us, why is there conflict between free-ranging, free-living dogs, which are sort of so comfortable with human beings? It doesn't make sense to have that kind of a conflict. The other part of it is significantly higher, which is humans causing fatalities to dogs and all kinds of injuries. But in this direction, again, it's maladaptive. They can't survive. A dog that bites a person or kills a person, it's not going to make it, period. Just not going to make it one way or the other. It's very maladaptive behavior.
Do you have a statistic for the number of dogs that live in India, either street dogs or owned otherwise?
Again, it's very difficult to estimate it. I've seen estimates that go from 1 million to 2 million. In my city, I've heard estimates of about 300,000 free-living dogs. But then again, the way these surveys are done is highly suspect. It's very, very difficult to get an idea. So yeah, take it with a lot of salt.
Yeah, I'd be curious. I'm leaning again towards the question. Okay, so we have so many free living dogs.
You're trying
there
to do the math.
Yeah, and compared to the U.S., but also, you know, we don't have many free living dogs here. Depending on what part of the country you are, yes, but it's obviously much different environments, much different culture. And, you know, got me thinking about, you know, how often the dog bites happen based on that aspect of the behavior. So we have these free living dogs that are much more integrated into society where you are than they are here in many cases, and how much that impacts aggression. So the next question that was coming to mind was about groups of dogs living together. So packs of dogs living together, and how often you might see an aggression case or some aggression incident when there's a group of dogs engaging what they would refer to as a pack attack. So when I was in Australia, I saw some, you know, statistics on that, or some talk about, you know, especially in the more rural areas, they actually have training for some of the civilians or the people that live in those areas to, for safety purposes, how to kind of move by or avoid those kind of pack attacks. Do you see any of that in India, or is it because there's just so many dogs and so many people that it's less likely to occur?
We do see it. Obviously, we do see it. I'm going to answer that question, but before I do, I think your earlier train of thought kind of inform that. And I will get you better data next time on this, provided you give me a heads up on what data you want me to bring, which you didn't this
time. You mean you don't know all this off the top of your head?
but I think the important question to ask is not how many bites or what percentage of bites that we see, but how many of the bites are pet dogs versus street dogs. And that, I think, is an important one, because in India, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but the bottom line is that it is more of the bites that we see are from pet dogs, known dogs, rather than street dogs. And that's significant, because the number of street dogs versus number of pet dogs that we have, there's a huge number difference. Again, no, you know, I don't have good numbers to give you. That's why I said you need to give me a heads up to get you some good resources with numbers. But I think that's very, very telling. And to me, that is very, very telling, because that is something that we do see. I am a behavior consultant, and that is something that I do see, is dogs that seem to be quite comfortable as a street dog, no bite issues. But when they get adopted, they do develop behavioral problems, going up to the point of even biting. And we see this repeated. I have some students who tell me that, you know, he was fine on the streets, but I adopted him because there were people beating him and I wanted to kind of rescue him. So I adopted him. But once I adopted him, he has turned very, in quotes, aggressive. And that's a post-adoption change that has happened. You'd imagine that a better life should mellow you down. But loss of freedom doesn't always work that way. It's you know, you choose to call it better life. I choose to call it loss of freedom. And it doesn't always work the way we... It's not a fairy tale ending for the dog. Not necessarily. And I think that's an important thing to remember. And to answer the other question about pack attacks, I think that's another interesting one that we're more likely to see with dogs that resemble so-called feral dogs a little bit more closely in terms of their ontology, their social structures, their lives. These are dogs that live on the outskirts of city limits. They're not integrated well with human beings. They are more shy, they're more wary, and they're more afraid. And if they're more fearful, they... You know, there's courage in numbers, so they band together. Their packs get bigger. Integrated dogs have smaller packs. And what's even more interesting, you know, I hear a lot of people talking about the word pack with dogs. I'm simply not convinced that they're pack animals. I think that there's a different word that needs to be used for them, because in my mind, a pack animal is an animal that relies on the pack for procuring food. That's kind of the primary thing, right? Dogs, integrated streeties, do not rely on their group to find food. In fact, they will break up from their group and go in smaller numbers, because if your primary mode of procuring food is begging, one cute little dog standing by the bakery begging is cute. A big pack of dogs is scary. They're not going to make it happen. That's just not going to work. And when they go scavenging, they tend to go either as individuals, or they might, and this is a very cute one, they tend to be seen in pairs during monsoons, because that's kind of the season when the female dogs are coming into heat and they're having this courtship. So you actually, and I do have some videos of it for sometime in the future, of the courtship, where they're actually playing the song and dance, and they're seen in pairs during the monsoon season, which is coming up in the next few months. So you don't see that much of pack behavior, other than if they're defending themselves. And that too, a lot of the defending of themselves is posturing. So gather all my friends and make as loud a noise as necessary. And you see that behavior too. For example, that movie, 101 Dalmatians, you see the what is that? The midnight... I forget it. The Midnight Symphony, is it? Where the dogs are kind of transferring this message through howls late at night. Oh my goodness, I've seen that happen. So they do, you know, dogs in one neighborhood, if they start making a ruckus, And that too, it's a fear-based thing, and which is kind of audible in the nature of the sound they produce. It's a very specific kind of a sound. And once that happens, you will see that the neighboring groups start kind of joining in the, they're not joining the attack. It's not like they're coming to this physical area. They're where they are. They have no clue what's going on. They're just, you know, in solidarity with my brothers and sisters kind of a thing. And they're kind of going at it. And howls travel even further along and longer distances.
There's a point that you were talking about the intelligence, and we're talking about just seeing so many intelligent behaviors, the cognitive abilities of these dogs that are free living versus dogs that are confined and not having that opportunity to learn from their experiences. What is the most interesting thing you've seen in that regard? So if you thought about a moment where you were just watching some dogs, some streeties, and you're like, oh my goodness, this is just really an amazing thing to witness that you would not see in, you know, necessarily a pet dog. What would that be?
I think the top of that list would be their social interactions. That is something that just blows my mind, because I think we oversimplify this when we talk about, particularly when we talk about socialization of dogs, right? And what are we trying to do? And to me, I feel like we're trying to oversimplify their social interactions, because their social interactions are so complicated and nuanced. You see them having a lot of opinions. It's not that I call these dogs very socially sophisticated, but that does not mean that they get along with every dog. That means that they negotiate difficult social situations very skillfully. And they do have difficult social situations. They do have rivalries. They do have, it's incredible. They will let a neighboring dog from one group pass through their territory, but not the other group. That group's dogs are not our friends. They are our enemies. These are our allies, kind of political alliances that are formed. You see friends stand up for each other. You see friends falling apart. They're no more friends. They don't want to share resources anymore. And then suddenly you see them. I remember one dog that I was working with. I had named her Kermit for some reason. And she had a friend called Crowley. And I had started feeding her. And then one day she just starts dancing. Suddenly she looks at the distance and she starts dancing, and I'm wondering what she's doing, and she's making these little whiny sounds, and this beautiful big dog walks in, and I called him Crowley, and she kind of steps away from her food, and it's like she was melting for him. She was having a moment, right? Total fangirl moment. I could see it. A lot of fawning kind of a behavior. And I know some people can get tempted to say, oh, this is a dominant dog who walked in and she was kind of showing reverence. But I will disagree, because something happened between them a few weeks later, and she was very pissed off with him. And when he came saying, can I get your food? She was like, no way, go to hell. She chased him off. She snarled and barked at him, and he was very surprised. Now it was his turn to try and be nice, and I could see a lot of fawning behaviors from his side, but she just didn't want to have anything to do with it. And she realized that, and I took sides. I took sides, and I said, look, she's the one who I started feeding, so, you know, I'm going to stand in her defense. And she realized that very quickly, that that was my intention, and she was like, yes, I got a human being, and I'm going to use my human being. Are you kidding me? That's incredible that you're actually able to use me as a resource like that, right? And what was really interesting is that a few weeks later, they had made up. And she was back to kind of offering his food, and I was trying to stand in defense, and she's like, oh, not necessary. I got this. We're cool. We're fine. And to me, the question that keeps coming back to my mind, I have Chiru here, my dog. It's an incredibly complicated social lives. How much of it do our dogs get to experience? What do we allow? Do we allow negative reactions at all? Do we allow a dog to actually say, yes, you can actually have negative feelings towards a dog and actually express it? That's not okay at all. And I think that really, really stands out to me.
Yes. And I can think of a couple of relationships I've had in the past that you were describing there.
Oh, for sure. You know, I know we've taken a lot of time, but I think you're going to love this particular story on relationships. My dog, Chiru, a lot of people ask, is your dog friendly? And I never know what to say when they ask that. Is your dog friendly? I don't know what that means. Yeah, she's friendly to dogs who she wants to be friendly to. And with dogs she doesn't want to be friendly with, she isn't. Much like me, right? And much like all of us. And so we were, sometime November last year, we were at a resort where there were, not a resort, a coffee estate kind of a thing, where there were about 7 free living dogs there. And Chiru walks in there and 6 of those dogs were quite okay with being friends with Chiru. They wanted to be friends with her. And Chiru just didn't get along with any of them. She either kind of turned a cold shoulder or she had a nasty thing or so to say to each of them. And then there was one dog who just didn't, who wanted to be left alone and didn't want to have anything to do with her. And that's the dog that she, my goodness, she danced and danced and danced for that guy. It was, I was embarrassed watching it. I was like, give up already. He doesn't want to be friends with you. Just give up. And she put on her best show for him. And I have videos of him actually coming right up to her face and growling at her. And she knew how to handle it. She didn't lose her cool. And she was really good at saying, hey, but I still like you. I still want to be friends with you. And I just was thinking, why is this dog acting so strange? And I realized, oh my goodness, I have videos from every year for the past 10 years where she's been doing this. She goes to a place, she finds the one dog that is not interested in being friends with her, and that's the one dog she puts all her effort into befriending. Now, tell me, we've all heard of relationships like this with people too, right? The one who is the hardest to get is the one we want to be friends with. That's who I was in college. The person I eventually married was the one who was least interested in me to start with. So how can I deny her of this kind of complexity? It is fun.
She sounds like the ambassador for her breed and for being a dog in that environment. That's such a great story. So Sindar, thank you so much for taking the time. Where can people find you and what are you up to next? Where do you want to direct them to?
Right. So people can find me on my website, www.barcs.com, that is BHARCS.com. I do have a book that's out called Dog Knows. I believe in the US it's only available on Kindle right now. And I've been trying to get my publishers to get the hard copy out. And we have a nice course on Udemy on dog communication with lots of beautiful little clips of dogs communicating with each other. And that's kind of my passion. And we have a workshop, about a 20-hour workshop to dive deeper into several of these topics. All of our education is completely online, accessible from everywhere. So yeah, that's on my list. And hopefully the next time we talk, we'll talk a little bit more about my research and things like that, because that's where my master's is taking me. And it's a very interesting one too.
I would love it. And I'm sure the listeners would love to have you back. So thank you so much again. And I look forward to talking to you again in the future.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed hearing from Sindar as much as I did about the lives of street dogs. She truly does have remarkable insights about dog behavior. If you like the show, please feel free to subscribe, share, and give a rating. And hop on over to aggressivedog.com for more information about helping dogs with aggression. From the Aggression in Dogs Master Course to webinars from world-renowned experts, and even an annual conference, we have options for both pet pros and pet owners to learn more about aggression in dogs.